BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. China orders the US to stay out of nuclear-armed Pakistan, but US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton refuses. What is she up to? And before he took over Avon and Somerset Police, our Chief Constable Colin Port spent 3 years in Northern Ireland heading up the inquiry into the 1999 assassination of Catholic solicitor Rosemary Nelson. The final inquiry into her murder was published on Monday. Well, 12 years on, there's still been no arrests, so we question the Avon and Somerset Chief Constable Colin Port's role in covering up collusion between the Northern Ireland Police and Loyalist terrorists, the UVF and UFF, and the so-called Red Hand Defenders. We also explore the possibility that three devastating world wars didn't just happen. Were they planned by shadowy characters behind the scenes 140 years ago? But first, in these modern wars NATO is starting nowadays, the Geneva Convention seems to be out of the window, with military jets and helicopter gunships attacking as many innocent civilians, it seems, as soldiers. Another change has been that radiation left on the battlefield after depleted uranium shells are fired is leading to long-term genetic defects and hideous birth deformities. Well, International Day for Innocent Child Victims of Aggression is coming up on Saturday, the 4th of June, and it's being celebrated here in Bristol. So I'm joined by Bristol writer and peace campaigner Joanne Baker. Hi, Joanne, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, thank you.
Now, can you tell us what you are planning for this International Day of Innocent Child Victims of Aggression? It's a bit of a mouthful, but what's going on?
Yes, it is. Well, this day was actually set up by the UN in the 1980s after Israeli aggression against Lebanon and Gaza, and their concern was that so many children were in fact being killed and maimed in these modern wars. So we decided to commemorate this in Bristol on Saturday the 4th of June, which in fact is the UN Day, and it's going to take place at St Stephen's Church, which is right in the centre of Bristol near Corn Street. It's between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. We're going to show a series of small films, short films on what life is really like for children in Afghanistan, Iraq and Gaza today. There will be displays and information stalls. There will be candles to light in the church and there's space for prayer and reflection on what these wars really mean. And there's also an excellent cafe there which serves really good food. So it should be an interesting way to spend your Saturday morning.
Well, would you just give us the times again? I know St Stephen's Church is in St Stephen's Street, amazingly enough, and just off the city centre. Mm-hmm. But is it the sort of event that if you're in town shopping you can just pop into?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yes.
So what the times?
The times are 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. So a really good time to go and have some coffee, maybe have your lunch there, and find out what's really happening in the world.
Martin, what is really happening in the world? Because this is a big change, isn't it? Even the Second World War, of course, we had bombing of big cities and things like that. But slowly but surely, it seems, with conflicts like Vietnam, there's been things like sort of carpet bombing and napalm. And now we have a lot of people dying who are completely innocent. I mean, we heard, for example, a few weeks ago about the drone attacks in Pakistan. Thousands of people dying in Pakistan who've got nothing to do with the Taliban or fighting or aggression, just being caught up in all this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously modern warfare is actually 80% plus civilian casualties. That's what it's, the whole of the 20th century, that's been true. I've just been reading a book about the 30 years war.
But why is that?
In the 1640s, and of course, you know, the civilians did suffer then, but it was much less than they do now.
But why is that? Why the big change?
It's the kind of weaponry that people are using.
Is it also maybe something to do, because that's what I was thinking in the back of my mind, something to do with the fact that a lot of it is counterinsurgency and is sort of guerrilla fighting?
You're fighting there are no non-combatants in modern warfare, effectively. I mean, if you're in the, I mean, most fighting takes place in populated places, like the fighting is Misrata in Libya at the moment, or Fallujah or Srebrenica, and the people are there in the way and people are shooting, and you know, people are going to get hurt, aren't they?
So I suppose the days of two armies actually on the battlefield as two
long
big blocks have gone a long, long time ago. But Joe, one of the things that really, really concerns me is all of the... Martin seems to be dying on the spot here. You just back off from the microphone when you're coughing, Martin. That'd be lovely. We have this problem with depleted uranium, particularly, which affects families and also can be passed on from mother to children and then through other generations.
Yes, I mean, I think this is one of the major problems of these wars, is that their effects are long-lasting. Just going back a moment to your children who are actually killed and maimed. I've just seen the UN studies done, and they say that in, for example, Afghanistan, 2010, there were 486 children killed and 910 maimed. Iraq, it was about 394 injured and about 232 killed, and these are really, there may be far more than that which we aren't really knowing about. So those are children who are killed and maimed. Many of these children are also, of course, losing their parents. In Iraq now, there's 5 million children. One out of three children in Iraq has lost one or more parents. So there's many children out on the streets and fending for themselves. And then when you come, as you say, to the illnesses, now we're all used to the long-term effects of war through landmines and cluster bombs, but uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years. It is there for the record. It'll be there forever and ever. It gets more radioactive as it breaks down. And what we're finding all throughout Iraq is these appalling real peaks in leukemia, very rare cancers, birth deformities. A study recently done by Dr. Chris Busby in Fallujah showed that the effects there already were worse than the aftermath of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Now, you've written a book called Uranium in Iraq, The Poisonous Legacy of the Iraq Wars, which you've handily put here for me to read out. Can you tell us how you, in a nutshell, really, how you went and did the research for that book?
This book came, I wrote it together with a friend of mine who's a barrister. He's actually Iraqi. He's called Abdulhaq Al-Ani. And we wrote the book after 2003, where we'd both been back to Iraq. And really, it was so shocking what was happening. We thought we must have a record of it. And at the back of the book, there's also the studies of many Iraqi scientists, excellent scientists who were working throughout the 1990s and never got their work heard because the British and Americans said they were working under Saddam Hussein. Therefore, you know, this work cannot be peer-reviewed or, you know, is going to be a bias, but in fact they were extremely good scientists doing the work the best they could under the sanctions.
Martin, what can be done about all this? Because it does seem that we're moving towards a state where it's just the survival of the fittest now, and the rule of law is almost out the window, especially when we're leaving these traces of depleted uranium around and causing birth defects around the world.
This is a very, very dangerous moment, probably the most dangerous moment since 1939. There is a real possibility that we're going to have a general world war as a result of all these minor wars gradually morphing into something more terrible. Haven't we learned our lesson? Obviously not.
Joanne, can you just remind us when this event is taking place? Saturday week, isn't it?
Yes, it's Saturday the 4th of June, St. Stephen's Church, right in the centre near the Hippodrome, and it's from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m.
And we'll be talking more about the potential world war and all the tensions between the United States and China, which are sort of on the back burner, not really in full public view, after some music.
Signal, it's all
Mood Swings there from 1992. That's Chrissie Hynde, and it sounds like Martin Luther King in the background, doesn't it? That's Spiritual High, and you'll be able to hear a long version of that, a remix version, remixed by yours truly. That's between 8 and 10 p.m. this coming Bank Holiday Monday. And actually, there's going to be quite a lot going on Bank Holiday Monday. Andrew Parsonage has very kindly organised a whole day of Bristol music, featuring Russ Conway, The Wurzels, Aka Bilk, Fred Wedlock, Julian Slade, Get the Blessing, The Blue Aeroplanes, and on and on and on. Personally, I will be plugging stuff by The Transpersonals, High Fiction Science, and others. So that's Bank Holiday Monday here on BCFM, May the 30th, 2011, from 9 a.m. until late, live on FM, and of course online, Bristol's finest, or live broadcasting marathon celebrating Bristol's greatest ever music. That's this coming Monday, Bank Holiday Monday, May the 30th. Now, Martin Summers is still here with me. Martin, just one quick story to look at, which we didn't have time for in the first hour. This is the dodgy dossier helper. Sir John Scarlett has taken a top Iraq oil job. Tony Blair's former spy chief has been criticised for taking a job with a multinational company which has won a lucrative contract to drill for oil in Iraq.
Well, I mean, it just, it's a revolving door, isn't it? You start off being in the public sector and you end up being in the private sector, lining your own pocket. Well, there we go.
So John Scarlett, I can also remember, was spearheading a campaign to sell MI6's files and information that it had gathered on people to big business as well.
Yes, well, what can we say? I mean, it's Statoil, actually, the company that he's working for is not actually a multinational. It's a Norwegian state-owned oil company. But actually quite efficient. That's the sort of thing we ought to have but don't.
Apparently, Statoil declined to say how much Sir John would be paid. A spokesman said he would be on an advisory board to help us understand the geopolitical context in which we operate. Do you think it's ever legitimate for someone to step out of being the Director General of MI6 into a job like this?
Frankly, no. No, there shouldn't be revolving doors. I mean, Tony Blair, for example, has made a fortune since he's been Prime Minister, basically getting favours from all the people he did favours for when he was Prime Minister. It's rotten.
Okay, Martin, thank you.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Now, on to Rosemary Nelson. And the Rosemary Nelson, before he took over, let's start at the beginning. Before he took over Avon and Somerset Police, our Chief Constable Colin Port here in Avon and Somerset spent 3 years in Northern Ireland heading up the inquiry into the 1999 assassination of Catholic solicitor Rosemary Nelson. Well, the inquiry into her murder was published on Monday. So, who was Rosemary Nelson? And what does the way her murder was investigated tell us about life before the end of the Troubles? And who was to blame for the Troubles? Well, the Northern Ireland Secretary Owen Paterson presented the report to the House of Commons on Monday. On the BBC's Joanna Shin was there.
The panel finds that some members of the RUC publicly abused and assaulted Rosemary Nelson on the Garvahy Road in Portadown in 1997, having the effect of legitimising her as a target. The report also says, we believe that there was some leakage of intelligence which we believe found its way outside the RUC, and that the leakage increased the danger to Rosemary Nelson's life.
The Shadow Northern Ireland Secretary, Sean Woodward, said he felt concerned by the report.
I am unable to draw the same level of comfort about the findings and implications as he has done in his statement. The inquiry raises very serious issues about the police and about the Northern Ireland office.
As a former Northern Ireland secretary himself, Sean Woodward said he had reason to be grateful to both these institutions, but...
You can be grateful to these agencies, Mr. Speaker, and at the same time set apart wrongdoing and failings. What is clear is that in the case of Rosemary Nelson, her death was not inevitable. The Secretary of State quotes in the report that there is nothing that any organisation can do that will infallibly prevent a murder What can be reasonably looked for is a reduction in the risk. Well, that reduction was not reasonable. That risk could have been reduced, and it was not reduced. There were failings.
The SDLP's Margaret Ritchie had a personal connection to Rosemary Nelson.
Having known Rosemary Nelson when we were both students at Queen's University Belfast in the mid-1970s, I want to say that I find this report very disturbing indeed. And in particular, I would refer to the fact that it says we cannot exclude the possibility of a rogue member or members of the RUC or the Army in some way assisting the murderers to target Rosemary Nelson. Does the Secretary of State not agree with me that this is tantamount to collusion?
The Northern Ireland Secretary replied that it had been an exhaustive report which found no evidence of that sort.
Well, Channel 4 News actually interviewed Catholic lawyer Rosemary Nelson just 1 week before she was killed, and they interviewed her actually about the death threats that had been made against her by the Northern Irish police officers. Jane Dodge from Channel 4 News reports.
Rosemary Nelson on the steps of Number 10 2 months before her death. She was there for talks with the then Prime Minister Tony Blair. With her, Catholic residents of Gavahi Road in Portadown, a flashpoint for Northern Ireland's Orange Order parades. She worked out of a small office in Lurgan. Her clients included several well-known Republicans like dissident Colin Duffy, pictured here in 1997. That made her a target for loyalists. In March 1999, she died after a bomb attached to her car exploded as she drove from her home. The Red Hand defenders claimed responsibility. From the start, there were allegations that the security forces had also been involved.
It's taken 12 years to publish this report. It concludes that there's no evidence that any act by the security forces directly facilitated the murder of Rosemary Nelson. But it confirms that some police officers did threaten her and assault her, and that had the effect of legitimising her as a target in the eyes of loyalist paramilitaries.
One of Mrs. Nelson's clients said during his interrogation, an officer told him, "You're dead, tell Rosemary she's going to die too." Another client said he was told by police, "She won't be here that long, she will be dead." Rosemary Nelson confirmed she'd received threats from the police in an interview with Channel 4 News just a week before she was killed.
Well, I think anybody who deals with these politically sensitive cases is subject to this treatment. It's an ongoing, concerted, systematic series of threats which are issued by police officers.
Thousands attended her funeral. This murder was particularly shocking. A solicitor targeted because of the people she represented, and a state that had failed to safeguard her life, according to today's report.
So far, no one has been charged with any offence in connection with her murder. To paraphrase the mother of Stephen Lawrence, who summed things up brilliantly last week, society benefited, but Rosemary got no justice.
That was the voice of Rosemary Nelson's brother, Ewan McGee, there, ending Monday's report by Jane Dodge for Channel 4 News. And you also heard Rosemary Nelson herself there talking to Channel 4 News a week before she was murdered about the death threats coming from the Northern Ireland Police Service. Now, Martin Summers, is this just another mealy-mouthed government cover-up like David Kelly here?
Well, I obviously haven't read the report, but the listeners will have got the gist from listening to the clips that you've played. This particular incident is only one incident in a whole list of similar incidents of collusion between the RUC Special Branch, in particular the Army's Force Research Unit, and the Loyalist paramilitaries.
But Rosemary was a solicitor acting as a court solicitor. Surely she shouldn't be
That's right.
Surely she shouldn't be the target. Can I just finish my sentence? Surely she shouldn't be the target for threats and assaults by police.
No, she shouldn't, and that's clearly wrong. And the suggestion is that she was set up by the security forces to be murdered, and the Loyalist. But what many people in Britain don't understand is that the Loyalist terror campaign was basically being directed by the British Army and the RUC. So when the IRA were carrying out their actions, they were, as they would see it, responding to the actions of the Loyalist paramilitaries, the Army and the RUC, who were basically a unit. Brian Nelson, who was the Chief Intelligence Officer of the Ulster Defence Association, basically in charge of targeting, was a British agent for many, many years. He used to work for Brigadier Brigadier Gordon Kerr, then Colonel Gordon Kerr, who headed up the Force Research Unit. So in other words, basically, Britain has got dirty hands in Ireland, but are we surprised? Not really.
But clearly it was a sensible move to bring in Colin Port. He was at the time Deputy Chief Constable of Norfolk Police, because the Ulster Police could hardly be trusted to do an inquiry into a killing where they were the prime suspects.
Indeed. And of course, what tends to happen when these people come in, like Stalker or Sir John Stevens, is they either don't get to the bottom of it or they're blocked. But it was Sir John Stevens who named Brigadier Gordon Kerr as a terrorist and basically said that he would have to stand trial. But the British government said, thank you for all the good work you've done, Sir John Stevens, in uncovering this, but actually we're not going to pursue this. And the reason why the state doesn't want to pursue this is quite clear. It's basically because the state is guilty. The state is a terrorist. The British state is a terrorist state. It has been for a long time.
And it might open a can of worms. Well,
indeed.
Montpellier-based paratroop regiment veteran Richard Cowley did a tour of duty in Northern Ireland with the British Army, and he's been kind enough to put together a special report this week into the highly charged political build-up to and fallout from the assassination of Republican solicitor Rosemary Nelson.
She wasn't a Republican solicitor, she was a solicitor, but she had Republican clients and Loyalist clients as well, I believe.
The incident happened in 1999. It was on the morning of March the 15th, outside of her home. She lived in Lurgan. Rosemary Nelson was a prominent Northern Ireland solicitor who represented clients of the terrorist classification. She was about 40 years old, she was a mother of three, and she was often singled out by Loyalists and the RUC for verbal abuse and threats.
Now, the RUC is the Royal Ulster Constabulary. I mean, they were basically the police force in Northern Ireland.
That's correct. They had a local grudge against her, which accumulated over time because of her consistent defence of known IRA terrorists, which she invariably won against the RUC, obviously making them look less useful, as it were.
Why was she targeted more than other Belfast lawyers then?
There was the Drunk Cree case, the Robert Hamill case, and the Colin Duffy case. These three cases led to a hate campaign against her. If I could just go through the Drunk Cree case. The Nationalist Gavarkie Road area is on the edge of a predominantly Protestant area, Portadown. Rosemary Nelson, the solicitor, was legal advisor to the Gavarkie Road Residents Coalition, and the Drumcree dispute was sparked and widespread violence began, which led to a string of murders. And she became the target of Loyalist hostility due to that. Now, the second one is Robert Hamill. This is another case that she represented successfully. Portadown again, County Armagh area. He was attacked by a Loyalist mob in a notorious area in the centre of town. Mr. Hamill was knocked unconscious and died later, 12 days later, in fact, in hospital. Armed police in a Land Rover had been seen parked at the scene, and they were accused of failing to intervene in his attack. So
this, again, is the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the police force in Northern Ireland at the time.
Armed police. In this case, it was an armed police, which is the RUC. Now, his murder and the police failure to catch the killers was also compared, oddly enough, which has been in the news recently, with the teenager, the black teenager, Stephen Lawrence. Mrs. Nelson, the solicitor, then represented the entire Hamill family and became their voice. And she directly accused the RUC, the police, that is, and she lobbied pretty hard for the public inquiry into that particular case. An inquiry was then only granted after her death. This is, again, another example of the police failing to do their duty. Now, the third case, which is the most interesting of the three cases, is Colin Duffy. In 1919, Duffy, a prominent Republican IRA type of chap from Lurgan, County Armagh, survived a murder attempt against him while he was in fact reporting to the police station on bail conditions. There was a group of them, and of the three, a chap called Sam Marshall was in fact killed in the same attack.
So this was a kind of ambush, basically. As he was going to report into the police station as part of his bail conditions, he was ambushed.
It's quite likely that they knew the time that he was visiting, if it was a regular issue. And collusion is suspected, as you know, between the police and the Loyalists. Anyway, so this chap Marshall was killed in the same attack. And then Rosemary Nelson again stepped in as the defending solicitor. and she accused directly again the security forces of colluding with loyalists in that shooting. Later in 1993, this chap, Colin Duffy, recurs, you see, where he was jailed for killing a former UDR regiment soldier.
Now, what is the UDR?
The Ulster Defence Regiment.
Okay, so they're a regiment of soldiers made up mostly of loyalists, but a soldiers' regiment, part of the British Army.
Yes, the Ulster Defence Regiment is localised and recruits locally from people which obviously have a number of local loyalists within it.
It wasn't really balanced then between the Protestant and the Catholic community. It was almost all loyalists.
Yeah, it was entirely composed of selected loyalists. In 1993, Colin Duffy was jailed for killing a former Ulster Defence Regiment soldier in Lurgan, which is Rosemary Nelson's hometown, you see, and that's how she was drawn in to represent the locals in the area. He was then acquitted under Mrs. Nelson's representation. Of course, collusion, as we've already spoken about, exists in
it. That's one of the things about this Colin Duffy case, is it did actually reveal collusion, didn't it, between the police force and the loyalist terrorists?
Yes, yes, it certainly brought to light the obvious connection between the two things. It was highlighted as an example. A key witness, in fact, was later revealed to be a leading loyalist and paramilitary, a chap called Lindsay Robb, who was later jailed in 1995 for gunning down a loyalist Ulster Volunteer Force. His capture embarrassed the police, and therefore the Ulster Volunteer Force's political wing also. Later on in 1997, June in fact, Colin Duffy was again arrested, so this is getting quite regular now, and represented again by the solicitor Rosemary Nelson. He was released again when the case against him collapsed. He was charged as being one of the IRA gunmen who had shot at the police, basically the RUC, the Royal Ulster Constabulary officers, in Lurgan, 1 month before the IRA declared a renewed ceasefire. So he's obviously now, you know, on top of their priority, the local RUC police, for shooting at them, basically.
That's a pretty serious charge, that the police force were actually colluding with terrorists in Northern Ireland before the ceasefire.
Yeah, I mean, right through the inquiry, we've just heard the results of, and many other research papers that have been done, the consistency of collusion recurs. No matter where you go, what you hear, that's the common expression of the communication between the security forces, the FRU, Forces Research Unit, a chap called Gordon Kerr, and many other people in the police force, RUC, colluding with loyalists through the Ulster Defence Regiment and the UDA, the Ulster Defence Association. Were the police, however, colluding with loyalists against her specifically? And this is a point that has come up in the inquiry. Yes, the answer is to that. The RUC were obviously very closely involved, and their feelings were bitter, as we'll also see, towards her personally, and they were not the right people to fairly treat an inquiry. And then Colin Port was busting to take over. Colin Port, most people in Bristol probably never heard of Colin Port, but he's actually now the Avon and Somerset Chief Constable. So Colin Port called for an independent investigation team, which was partly made up of the original RUC Belfast police officers, you know, from that area, operating. Now, this is the strange thing. They were operating out of Lurgan Barracks, which is the very station from which most of the death threats against Rosemary Nelson were coming from. Hence, after 3 years on the case, is it therefore surprising that our friend Colin Port was able to find nothing and therefore prosecuted nobody? Colin Port's responsibility for protecting rather than questioning Rosemary Nelson's killers is slowly sinking in around Avon and Somerset. As in fact, since the Orange Order and Freemasonry are also clearly associated with the police, everyone is knows about that today, and they're also closely connected with loyalism within Belfast. Any association, therefore, that Colin Port made would have a Freemasonry sort of stamp of approval on it. Would this make his investigation against Rosemary Nelson and her murder just another travesty of justice.
So were there any police from the IUC involved actually in her murder?
I think yes to that. There appears to be, you know, a lot of the leading evidence. The public inquiry could find no direct security force link, but it says, I must underline, it does say that it didn't entirely rule out rogue elements of the police force that may have assisted the killers. So that we can't exclude the possibility of, say, rogue members of the RUC or the army in any way assisting the murder or the targeting of her at the time.
That was Richard Cowley there, who's a Montpellier-based former parachute regiment soldier who did a tour of duty in Northern Ireland with a special report on the murder of Rosemary Nelson and all the significant factors surrounding it. Now Martin Summers is with me. Martin, one of the things which is a factor in this particular case was that when Rosemary died, she had a bomb underneath her car, that there were military explosives used and a kind of a very high-tech kind of detonator, an explosive, which the loyalists had never been seen to use before.
That's very suspicious, isn't it? Very suspicious. Normally, in Northern Ireland, you might not think so, but there were rules by which the war was fought, and solicitors were not supposed to be targets. Pat Finucane was another solicitor or lawyer who was killed, and the loyalists would only kill lawyers with the connivance of the security forces.
Well, I suppose the loyalists needed lawyers themselves, didn't they?
Indeed. And therefore, I mean, when Pat Finucane was killed, the guy who actually did the shooting, he said, well, do you want me to kill this guy? I mean, are you sure? He's a lawyer. We don't kill lawyers, do we? And the police said to him, yes, go ahead, we want him dead.
Well, there was also the famous murder of Martin O'Hagan, who was also a journalist. Journalists were seen to be beyond the pale, and they certainly weren't involved in planting bombs, and not really legitimate targets. So it was getting pretty bad, wasn't it, around the time of the agreement, where solicitors and journalists were also being dragged into the conflict.
Yeah, but as we said earlier, the Force Research Unit, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, people can look this up on the internet, it's quite straightforward, they will see that in actual fact the Loyalist terror campaign was being directed by the army and the RUC, and that's why we've had to have a peace process. It's not just the Republicans who have been fighting, the British and the Loyalists have been fighting as well. Thank goodness we're largely over it now and everybody has found a way to peace, but let's not kid ourselves, there was more than one side involved in this. The British state's got a lot to answer for.
Yeah, there are certainly lessons to be learned, and it's a pity that Colin Port wouldn't be interviewed on the topic. Do you think Colin Port, our Chief Constable here in Avon and Somerset now, who was actually conducting most of that murder investigation, was himself threatened?
I've no idea. I mean, you'd have to ask him. I haven't got the faintest idea what is. I mean, his investigation obviously didn't uncover everything that needed to be uncovered, but then that's quite difficult to do.
Certainly difficult to do if you're basing your inquiry in the same police station where the death threats against Rosemary have been coming from.
Yeah. Well, Sir John Stevens did a pretty good job of exposing Brigadier Gordon Kerr. It took 14 years, though.
The other thing is, a car bearing the number plate associated with MI5 was spotted outside Rosemary's house the night before she pulled out of a drive and the car bomb exploded.
Yeah, well, it all adds up, doesn't it? So, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, by the way, just mentioned him, he has disappeared to Iraq. He's running something called the Joint Services Group inside the Green Zone, as the last time I heard of him. He may have moved from there now. But basically, he's got away with it. I mean, most of these people have got away with it.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Now, after looking back at that 12-year-old assassination, on to the future, where prospects for peace in Asia and the Middle East, I'm afraid, are also looking rather bleak. You may not have seen it on the BBC or read about it in your daily paper, but fast-rising Far East superpower China is getting tough with the United States, telling them that any further attacks in Pakistan, like the raid to allegedly kill bin Laden, will be considered as attacks on China. Webster Tarpley explained last week on his weekly World Crisis Radio report.
Welcome to this week's edition of World Crisis Radio. The world situation continues to deteriorate. The big news of the past 24 hours, an ultimatum issued by China against the United States: don't attack Pakistan or you will face retaliation from China. This is the first time in recent decades, the first time I can remember anybody issuing an ultimatum against the United States. We could, of course, go back to last week and reinterpret the Gilani speech about full force retaliation as an ultimatum in its own way. Now, taken together, these two statements unquestionably constitute ultimata. This is the kind of language we heard in July 1914. This is the kind of language we heard in late August 1939. When the great powers begin to issue ultimata one against the other, this is a sign of extreme, acute danger of general war. That is what we now have. It has been created by the Anglo-American imperialist madmen and their quest for confrontation with Pakistan, leading to a breakup of that country. They wish to destroy Pakistan as the leading strategic ally of China, and this has now been fully recognized in Beijing. But let's get to the number one story. This now comes from the Times of India, the section known as the Economic Times, and it's an article, deadline Beijing and Islamabad, China on Thursday, on the 19th of May. China on Thursday said the international community must respect, that's a quote, must respect Pakistan's sovereignty and territorial integrity. This is the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhang Yu telling the media at the press conference that, quote, the sovereignty and territorial integrity of China must be respected. She goes on to say, all quotes, we believe that Pakistan has made great contributions to international counterterrorism efforts as well as huge sacrifices. The international community should understand and support Pakistan's effort to restore national stability and develop its economy. We have Prime Minister Gilani of Pakistan in Beijing. We'll have more on that visit in a minute. But Gilani tells Pakistan that he met with Premier Wen Jiabao, and the Gilani quote is, China supports Pakistan on its own. I think it means as its own, that China is as committed to Pakistan as it is to itself. In other words, it's a complete alliance. Gilani says, quote, there should be no harm to the Pakistani sovereignty, and the U.S. should understand and appreciate it. But now here's the heart of the matter. The News of Pakistan quotes Chinese diplomatic sources, and the Chinese diplomatic sources say China has, quote, warned in unequivocal terms that any attack on Pakistan would be construed as an attack on China. Let me repeat that. China has warned the United States, quote, warned in unequivocal terms that any attack on Pakistan would be construed as an attack on China, end quote, say diplomatic sources to the News of Pakistan. And this warning, according to this article in the Times of India, the warning was formally conveyed by the Chinese foreign minister at last week's China-U.S. strategic dialogue and economic talks in Washington. That's an ultimatum. The Soviet Union, to my knowledge, never issued any ultimatum against the United States. Never. The new U.S. regional envoy, the one who's responsible for the Pakistan-Afghanistan portfolio, this is now Mark Grossman. And Mark Grossman has been asked by a number of Pakistani media, will you give us guarantees that there will be no repetition of these unilateral raids? Now, the average listener, the average reader, thinks this refers to the bin Laden stuff. This is simply superficial. It refers to the nuclear forces. And the answer from Grossman is no. No assurances will be given. In effect, the U.S. rejects the ultimatum. We're in July 1914. We're in August 1939. Watch out, world. We'll be back in a minute.
Webster Tarpley there on his very own World Crisis Radio weekly report in the US on the radio, and of course we can hear it here, pick it up here on the internet. Now Martin Summers, he's being a little bit dramatic there, isn't he, talking about 1914, 1939 ultimatums being refused by the US. I mean, of course there was an ultimatum by the Soviet Union against the US and in fact all of the Western powers as regards the Berlin airlift, but it really, we do have to go back that far before we find an ultimatum like this one from China to the United States saying you better stay out of Pakistan or else.
Yes, and it's not been reported in the mainstream media, isn't it, has it? I mean, it's hardly been mentioned.
No, but it has been talked about definitely over in that part of the world.
Of course, yes, in Pakistan, everybody's very aware. Yeah.
And, of course, we've also recently had another raid in Pakistan, haven't we, which is apparently by the Taliban into I think it's a naval air station, wasn't it, in
Pakistan? They got some very high-tech aeroplanes. Mohammed Gul, who used to head up the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services, as General Gul, he said he thinks that the Americans are behind that attack. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, but what people in Britain have got to realise is that senior military officers in Pakistan believe that the Americans are engaged in terrorism inside Pakistan. And if you read the Pakistani press, you will know what their opinion
of
that
is. Well, people like Raymond Davis, of course, the guy who was caught by the Pakistanis.
He shot a couple of guys who may well have been ISI agents, that's right. Yeah.
He was caught actually running nuclear and possibly chemical weapons to the Taliban, actually selling them.
Yeah,
to
I mean, what people have got to realise is that the Chinese are very keen to build an oil pipeline through Pakistan to the Indian Ocean, which would mean that they could then get oil from the Middle East without it having to go through the Straits of Malacca and in super tankers and then round to Shanghai. They could get the oil in much more easily if they could get a pipeline through Pakistan. And the Pakistanis are keen. They've agreed to build a naval base for the Chinese on that coast. But the Americans are absolutely opposed to that, absolutely opposed to it. And that is why they're destabilising Pakistan. They're encouraging separatist movements. They're basically encouraging terrorism of all kinds inside Pakistan. This is the view of the Pakistani military. They may be wrong, but that is their view.
And I suppose the Chinese are looking at Pakistan and saying, well, hang on a minute, you better not... If they can get away
well,
with it,
Pakistan... I think it was the attack on the so-called murder of... Abbottabad, because it was named after Major General Abbott, I believe. Basically, that little shenanigan or play acting, as it seems to be. I mean, nobody in Pakistan is at all convinced that Osama bin Laden was anywhere near that compound, or that the Americans it killed him. I mean, basically, the Americans got a huge credibility problem. They can say what they like, and their own populations go, "Oh, yes, we've killed Osama bin Laden," but nobody else in the world believes them. Nobody. I don't suppose the Chinese believe them, but what they do see is that the Americans are making pressure. Don't forget, this place was right next to the Pakistani military academy. In other words, it's a way of kicking sand in the eyes of the Pakistani military. And the Pakistani military are getting together with the Chinese military and saying, well, the Chinese military, we're going to take you on, America and Britain. We're going to take you on.
And what about this whole business last week? In fact, it was last Friday. Didn't manage to talk about it on our show because it just passed me by. But the Obama overturning the War Powers Act and ignoring Congress on the Libya war.
Well, I mean, basically, I mean, the rule of law long ago disappeared in the United States of America. What they're supposed to do, they just ignore. Basically, the military-industrial complex pretty much gets its way, whoever the president is. And the fact that he didn't bother to actually ask Congress whether he could go to war with Libya is neither here nor there. They never do. They ought to, but they never do.
Anyway, certainly Webster Tarpley and other commentators do see this as a push towards World War III. And we're going to hear another clip from Webster now, talking on the Alex Jones Show.
The U.S. British ruling elite has gone collectively insane, and that they're in a war psychosis. They're also in an austerity psychosis. They're obsessed with the idea that the dollar and all of their derivatives are going down the drain, and they're in a flight forward. So this is a time of tremendous irrationality. The problem we have is that the general public remains unaware of most of these very, very shocking and very, very disturbing and scary events, primarily because the entire left opposition, so-called peace movement and related people, foundation funded in particular, have essentially given up on opposing Obama.
Well, Tarpley's talking about collective insanity there.
Yes, I'm afraid so. If you know anything about history, he's a historian. If you know anything about history, it's very, very worrying indeed, because basically most wars start because people have lost their marbles, and these people have definitely lost their marbles.
Now, World War III sounds impossible, but where are the potential flashpoints? We've just heard about Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, there's an arc of instability from the Middle East through the former Soviet republics and into the Indian subcontinent. I mean, that is basically what will go up in one big go. And of course, once one war starts, for example, you know, with Pakistan, for example, or India, then it'll spread across that arc of instability. And of course, we're not going to escape here in Britain.
What about the link to the economics of all of this? Because if we go back to the beginning of World War II, there were tremendous economic troubles just before World War II started.
Yeah. I mean, basically, you know, what does it say in Henry V? We must giddy simple minds with foreign quarrels. You know, when people are losing their jobs, losing their houses, losing their future, we've got to find an enemy, haven't we? And we're doing quite good at finding some enemies.
Okay, and economically speaking, we've got the G8 conference this weekend, which the Russians go along to, of course, these days. It used to be the G7, it's now got the Russians in, it's the G8. But there's a kind of counterbalance, that's the Shanghai Cooperation Organisation, and they'll be meeting in a few weeks' time.
Yeah, I mean, but the Shanghai Cooperation Organisation was set up by the Russians and the Chinese, and basically all of the countries in between Russia and China, most of them are members. Iran is a honorary member, I think, or an observer member. And if there is a World War III, it'll be the Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries versus Britain and Europe.
Okay, so...
US and Europe, sorry.
So, you know, can you see the world then being divided kind of into two big economic blocks, one being a kind of NATO G8 block and the other one, the Shanghai...
Well, it's already
and
happening.
...the Chinese.
It's already happening. I mean, it's happening in front of our eyes.
So do you think there are quite a few countries around the world that are thinking, well, which side of this do I want to be on? And, and actually being, in a way, forced to make a decision to one or the other and finding it very difficult.
If you think at countries like Tajikistan and Uzbekistan, they're right in the middle of this. Azerbaijan... Armenia, Georgia.
Well, we've just seen a lot of problems in Georgia this week. So are they on this fault line you were talking about?
Yes, they're,
as well?
They're absolutely on that fault line, yep.
And do you think that quite a lot of what's been going on with the Arab Spring is also related to all of this?
And this
fault line kind of splitting?
Well, what I think about the Arab Spring is that there was a lot of accumulated discontent in all of those societies, but the timing of the Arab Spring has been decided, I think, by intelligence agencies in the West. Now we know, as we said earlier, about Operation Southern Mistral 2011 on the French Air Force website. People can look it up. It's all in English. They were planning a war on Libya in November last year, before anybody started demonstrating in Egypt or anywhere else. This suggests to me that the West has a plan, and they are enacting that plan. The Chinese and the Russians are not going to sit back and let them get away with it. And plenty of other people are going to fight back as well.
Well, just one last sort of ingredient in the mix here. I picked up a story in last Sunday's Sunday Express, which I didn't find anywhere else. In fact, the places mentioned in it weren't anywhere else. And this is by Marco Glanagelli, who's the defence correspondent for the Sunday Express. He says that British scientists are preparing to help American experts take control of Pakistan's nuclear facilities.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the Pakistanis are being bullied enormously by the West. They are very angry about it because, of course, they see a lot of the terrorism inside Pakistan as being fomented by the Indian Army's Research and Analysis Wing, the CIA and Mossad. And they're probably not wrong. That is probably exactly what is going on.
And the article finishes, a source said the US is concerned about the nuclear facilities of Pakistan when they have something like 25 different nuclear facilities and a whole load of nuclear weapons. But the US is concerned about these facilities falling into the wrong hands, and they are willing to take steps to deal with the situation. This will include American and British nuclear experts.
Well, the Pakistanis just going to say, we've got our nuclear weapons, get your hands off. How would we like it if the Pakistanis came here to get rid of our nuclear weapons because we're a threat? Who's a real threat in the world? Who's a real threat?
Well, here's a weird one now. Some people believe that both World War I and World War II did not just happen, but the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo in 1914, which sparked the First World War, and the rise of the Nazi Party, which set World War II off, were planned by bankers and even top Freemasons way back in the 1870s. They cite a letter alleged to have been sent in 1871 by US Freemason chief Albert Pike to European Freemason leader Giuseppe Mazzini. Erin Moriarty, who who's done a film called which is called Ring of Power, and her website is freetheearth.com. She takes up the story.
In a letter to Mazzini dated August 15, 1871, Pike graphically outlined a blueprint for three planned world wars. World War I would weaken, topple, and destroy the powerful Tsarist government in Russia. World War II would pit Great Britain against Germany, destroy Nazism, and create the Zionist State of Israel. World War III would be ignited by fueling aggression between the Zionists of Israel and the Arab world, who would eventually destroy one another. Social, political, and economic chaos would then force the masses to accept one world army and one world government.
Well, it sounds balmy, doesn't it? Is there any credibility at all to the idea that, these kind of wars can be orchestrated?
Basically, all wars are planned by somebody. Let's face it, there's a planning process involved in any kind of fighting. But the idea that it's all been orchestrated from by a group in the 1870s, I find basically untenable. There's plenty of people out there plotting things, but not in the 1870s. They're plotting them right now.
But why is it that the economic depressions always seem to be straight before world wars?
It's because basically wars are part of the capitalist system. When the capitalist system goes into a crisis, you have a war. That's what happens. And then at the end of the war, you generally have a remaking of the system and it reboots. And the war is part of the capitalist way of life. Of course, it's not just part of the capitalist way of life. You used to have feudal wars and you used to have wars in Paleolithic. But basically, war and world war is part of the DNA of capitalism. And if we don't get rid of capitalism, capitalism is going to get rid of us.
Do you think it's also possible that the only way to actually convince people that it's worth fighting a world war is to get them really impoverished before you even start?
Well, it's not basically that the tensions caused by economic failure lead to war. That's what happens. I mean, you can see the Arab Spring curdling in front of our eyes from being a popular uprising into basically becoming a march to war. And that's pretty appalling, but that's the kind of thing that happens.
Because when Hitler came to power in Germany in the 1930s, he was seen as an absolute miracle maker. He'd put the economic situation back on the right track.
Exactly. I mean, it was the Wall Street crash of 1929 that brought Hitler to power.
We'll see how things go, but you think that there's this arc, just briefly, in half a minute, whereabouts do you think the most important flashpoints are?
Well, I mean, all along that fault line, there is a possibility of fighting. I mean, fighting is actually taking place in many of the places along that fault line. World War III will creep up on people bit by bit. If you are living in Pakistan today and your mosque is bombed, you're already in it.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks, Martin. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour. That's the new Lib Dem councillor for Clifton East, Christian Martin. Thanks also to Joanne Baker. Next week, a special report on the biggest secret of the political world in the West. NATO's annual Bilderberg Conference attracts the richest and most powerful bankers, royalty and media bosses. And the politicians that go are sworn to secrecy. Well, it was all started back in 1954 by an MI6 Freemason and a former SS officer. Bilderberg meet in Switzerland in a fortnight, so we'll be covering that and hopefully including some live reports over the next 2 weeks. Well, this programme can be found on the internet at thisweek.org.uk, where you can hear all our previous Friday drive times. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody